Van Hale will discuss history and criticism of the text of the King Follett Discourse. Following Mr. Hale's comments, we will enjoy a response from James B. Allen, who is professor of history at BYU. Thank you.
There is a handout that I've prepared that may possibly be of some advantage to you. As I go along here, I see that a number of them have circulated. If you don't have one, you might look around for one. Conditions were described as beautiful. The countryside was turning green, and the blossoming peach trees were attracting the season's first butterflies. It was the dawning of spring at Nauvoo in April 1844. It was nature's time for new life, for new expression, and for the saints gathering to Nauvoo to celebrate the 14th anniversary of the Restoration, it was to be a time for a new expression of Mormon doctrine. In sharp contrast to this scene, an ominous cloud of anti-Mormon sentiment, which had been gathering for several years among non-Mormons, was about to be seeded by a group of Mormon dissenters. The ensuing storm resulted in the darkest day in Mormon history, June 27, 1844, the martyrdom of the prophet Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram. The several causes of their deaths included the events of the five-day conference, specifically Joseph Smith's April 7 address, known since as the King Follett Discourse. Behind the temple, in a grove specially prepared for the occasion, Smith approached the stand at 3:15 p.m. He looked out over the largest congregation of saints ever assembled during his life and delivered what has become his most famous sermon and perhaps the most famous ever in Mormonism. The discourse was given in honor of Elder King Follett, who had been killed accidentally while digging a well. Although a number of topics were covered, the most prominent doctrine and that for which it is most remembered is the plurality of gods. He declared, "Open your ears and hear, all ye ends of the earth. God himself was once as we are now and is an exalted man. He was once a man like us, yea, that God himself, the Father of us all, dwelled on the earth the same as Jesus Christ. You have got to learn how to be gods yourselves and to be kings and priests to God the same as all gods have done before you." These ideas had been discussed in private circles for several years, but were not taught openly or as church doctrine, and most members were probably unfamiliar with them. In fact, 3 weeks prior to the discourse, the saints had been counseled by Hiram Smith to let the matter of the grand councils of heaven and the making of gods entirely alone until by and by. On June 16, Smith said that it had been his intention for a long time to take up this subject and lay it clearly before the people, but it was not until after his conference address that these ideas were generally known and accepted by the saints. Within a few months following the discourse, this doctrine in part was published by Orson Pratt under the heading The Mormon Creed, and in an article entitled The Living God, John Taylor proclaimed that, quote, "it may be well enough to say at the outset that Mormonism embraces the plurality of gods." No one familiar with any era of Mormonism will be surprised to discover that there were widely varied reactions to the introduction of this major new doctrine. Most members accepted the doctrine as glorious new truth, but not all. 2 months prior to the discourse, Smith called attention to what has been an ever-present segment within Mormonism. Quote, "I have tried for a number of years to get the minds of the saints prepared to receive the things of God, but we frequently see some of them, after suffering all they have for the work of God, will fly to pieces like glass as soon as anything comes that is contrary to their traditions. They cannot stand the fire at all." The events immediately following the discourse proved Smith's perception accurate. Within 11 days, his second counselor, William Law, was excommunicated for his active opposition to Smith's doctrine and politics. By the end of April, Law rallied a number of Nauvoo citizens, some of considerable prominence, to his Reformed church. They denounced Smith as a fallen prophet for several reasons, one of which was that, quote, "he introduced false and damnable doctrines into the church, such as a plurality of gods above the God of this universe. We therefore are constrained to denounce them as apostates. Among the many items of false doctrine that are taught the church is the doctrine of many gods, one of the most direful in its effects that has characterized the world for many centuries." Although the death of Joseph and Hiram brought the demise of the Reformed Church, the dissension and divisions it had instigated and encouraged continued. Many of its members and sympathizers became prominent in the several schismatic groups which were organized in succeeding years. After Smith's death, the position of the 12 to, quote, build up the kingdom upon the foundation that the prophet Joseph has laid was stated and restated frequently. This foundation included the plurality of gods and related ideas from the King Follett discourse. Before the Nauvoo Exodus, the discourse was published four times, and the plurality of gods was taught openly by church leaders on a number of occasions. The position of the 12 was clear, and this was a factor in causing some to reject their leadership. Those who rejected the doctrine when taught by Joseph Smith predictably rejected it when advocated by the 12. In opposition to the 12, most of the breakoffs claimed Smith had fallen into doctrinal error. They accepted his earlier teachings but rejected the plurality of gods and several other doctrines advanced by Smith the last several years of his life. While some of these groups ignored the plurality of gods, most totally rejected it. None accepted it as basic doctrine, as did the church under the leadership of the 12. Those who rejected Smith's teaching of this doctrine included the followers of William E. McClellan, David Whitmer, Sidney Rigdon, James J. Strang, Granville Hedrick, and William Bickerton. After the passing of some 30 years, a third attitude of particular interest to this discussion emerged, finding support in the 1870s among the LDS and in the 1890s among the RLDS. The LDS position had been consistent and firm. Joseph Smith had not erred in doctrine. Although less consistent and less firm by the 1890s, the same position also prevailed among the RLDS. The difficulty posed by the King Follett discourse was that it contained doctrines which had become unacceptable to both churches. The doctrines were different, but the problem was the same. To accept the report of the discourse as accurate was to admit disharmony between the doctrine of Joseph Smith and the doctrine then current in the church. For members of both churches, it was more acceptable to doubt or deny the accuracy or even the authenticity of the reports than to admit the disharmony. But before assessing the LDS and RLDS criticisms of the report of the discourse, a history of its text is essential. As Joseph Smith spoke on April 7, 1842, four men independently recorded his sermon. Thomas Bullock and William Clayton had been assigned clerks of the conference, and each man's conference report contains his report of this discourse. For 2 years, Willard Richards had been responsible to keep Smith's private diary, in which he had recorded a number of Smith's sermons, including this one. In addition to these three official reports is that of Wilford Woodruff, who throughout his life kept a comprehensive diary which has been a rich source of history. After taking notes at the time of the discourse, he later wrote them into his diary. Although none of the four were trained in taking stenographic or word-for-word reports, all had significant prior experience in reporting discourses and were capable of recording accurately Smith's teachings on that occasion. These four reports are preserved in the LDS archives and have recently been published in the volume, The Words of Joseph Smith. April 10, 1844, the day after the close of the conference, Thomas Bullock, according to his diary, met with the 12 to arrange the minutes. He was delegated the responsibility of preparing the conference minutes for publication. He was provided with Clayton's set of minutes, and from April 23 to 28, he combined or amalgamated the two reports into one, which was fuller and more complete than either separately. Upon completion, publication of the conference minutes began on May 1st, 2 months before Smith's death, and was continued in semi-monthly installments in the church's Times and Seasons until discontinued after the August 15, 1844 issue. It was in the August 15 issue that the Bullock-Clayton amalgamation first appeared in print. It was from this Times and Seasons printing that the discourse was republished three more times by 1846. In 1855, the manuscript of Joseph Smith's history, which eventually became the six-volume history of the church, was being completed in Salt Lake City by the historian's office staff. A clerk in that office, Jonathan Grimshaw, who had been assigned to prepare Smith's sermons for the history, began work on a new text of the discourse. His approach on the new text was to produce the fullest possible report by amalgamating the Richards and Woodruff reports with the 1844 Bullock-Clayton amalgamation from the Times and Seasons. If you look at that handout, you will notice that the first two columns were amalgamated. As you examine those, you will be able to see that they were combined in 1844 to become the Times and Seasons account. The next three columns were combined in 1855 to become the account which now appears in the history of the church. Thus, the information from all four sources was brought together into one report. The result was an expansion of the text of the 1844 amalgamation of about 50%. This was an expansion of words, not of doctrines or ideas. In fact, the Richards and Woodruff reports contain no doctrines not found in the 1844 text. Rather, the result was the filling out of phrases and ideas already in the first text, which you see from the six column parallels that you have. This process did, however, result in some awkwardness occasionally. For example, at one point, Grimshaw chose to transfer a portion of two reports instead of amalgamating them, so that in the final report it appears that Smith made two similar statements when in reality the final version contains two similar reports of only one statement. Although there are some minor problems in this process, the combination of words and phrases was an effective process of almost producing Smith's very wording. In fact, in numerous instances, his exact wording can be determined with considerable confidence. As to thought and meaning, a comparison of the four reports reveals a strict harmony, as does a comparison of the 1855 amalgamation with the four reports. Comparison will not support a claim of any substantial alteration or discrepancy in doctrine among any of the four reports or two amalgamations. These are, however, general observations, and it could readily be demonstrated that a slight change in word order or even the placement of a comma could be significant, and thus the importance of going behind the amalgamations to the basic four reports on a technical point must be noted. Grimshaw began his work on the sermon October 3, 1855, and completed it the 15th of the same month. On November 5, Thomas Bullock and church historian George A. Smith read the completed text, which they, quote, carefully revised and compared. It was, quote, read in council Sunday, 18th November, 1855, and carefully revised by President Brigham Young. And the one revision that was made by Brigham Young under his direction is the part that you see on the back of that of the handout. Grimshaw's copy containing revisions in his handwriting and that of Bullock and Albert Carrington is filed in the Joseph Smith Collection in the LDS Archives. With perhaps one exception, and that's the exception on the back of the page, the revisions are minor in nature and do not add to, delete, or alter any of the basic doctrines of the discourse, but only improve readability, fluency, and clarity. By April 5, 1856, it was written into the manuscript of Joseph Smith's history. From this manuscript, the Deseret News printed the 1855 amalgamation for the first time in its July 8, 1857 issue. This printing has been the basic source for all subsequent printings of the discourse by the LDS Church. Recently, in the winter 1978 issue of BYU Studies, the four reports have been newly amalgamated. Several new features were added to this process, resulting in a still further improved text. Considerable effort was expended to report the discourse by four competent reporters. Through the process of amalgamation, the reports of the four were united to produce the fullest possible version and to ensure its accuracy. It was compared with the originals, reviewed and revised several times by men who had heard the discourse, men who had also been intimate associates of Joseph Smith and had firsthand knowledge of his doctrinal beliefs, and were qualified to recognize if any of the doctrines in the reports did not harmonize with what they knew to be Smith's teachings. All reliable information supports the current version as being the result of a significant and conscientious effort to produce a faithful and an accurate report of this discourse. In addition to this discourse, reports of Smith's teaching the same doctrines on other occasions in public and private have been preserved. Although it must be recognized that the current version is not, for the most part, a word-for-word report, to doubt that it accurately presents Joseph Smith's teachings on that occasion is unreasonable. The LDS and RLDS criticisms of the report can now be assessed. The RLDS Church has published substantial criticism of the discourse from the 1890s to the present. The doctrine of the plurality of gods was responsible for their rejection of it. Early in RLDS history, some of the leading authorities proclaimed and defended this doctrine, while others denounced it. It was accepted by Isaac Sheen, Zenas Gurley, and W.W. Blair, and rejected by Joseph Smith III and Jason Briggs. Although in 1864 those favoring the doctrine charged those who rejected it with apostasy, by the 1890s Briggs' position that the plurality of gods was, quote, the doctrine of men and the doctrine of devils, prevailed. However, to reject the plurality of gods meant either to reject a teaching of Joseph Smith or to reject the report of the discourse. And of course the latter was more acceptable, and a number of reasons for rejecting the discourse were advanced. In 1893, the RLDS Church published their abstract of the Temple Lock case, including part of James Whitehead's testimony stating, quote, I heard what is known as the King Follett sermon preached. That sermon was published. Joseph Smith did not in that sermon teach the plurality of gods. However, the following significant lines in the original transcript were omitted in the RLDS abstract. Quote, he did not that I know of. If he did, I did not hear it, but I was not there all the time he was preaching, for I was called out for a time. In 1896, the RLDS History of the Church presented four arguments suggesting suspicion as to its genuineness, which have persisted to the present. These four points deserve a response. First, the sermon was said to be a very long one, while this extract covers less than 5 pages of the times and seasons and can leisurely be read in about 25 minutes. One cannot get the true sense of the discourse from so meager an extract. According to the minutes, the sermon lasted 2 hours and 15 minutes. At a moderate speed, the 1855 version can be read in about 1 hour. The apparent conclusion is that only one half of Joseph Smith's sermon was recorded collectively, and less than that individually. However, a close examination of the four manuscript reports refutes this conclusion. There is such a close thought-for-thought parallel in the four reports that it appears that the 1855 amalgamation is a very comprehensive report of the ideas Joseph Smith presented. An examination of parallel number one on the plurality of gods, which is quite representative of the entire discourse, is convincing evidence that the true sense of Smith's sermon on this doctrine is accurately stated in the 1855 version. In fact, so many of the identical words are found in more than one report that the 1855 version appears to present much of Smith's very wording. Of course, there is no doubt that a stenographic report would vary from the 1855 version, but probably in wording only, not in doctrine. Also, throughout the four reports, there is no difficulty harmonizing the ideas as presented in each, and comparison reveals little ambiguity and no contradiction. The 1855 version is much more than a meager extract, and does indeed present the true sense of Smith's sermon. This conclusion forces consideration of alternative reasons as to why its presentation required 2 hours and 15 minutes. What follows is admittedly speculative, but not unreasonably so. With no public address system, Smith's frequent public speaking engagements were a great strain on his voice. And because of this weakened condition, his discourse had to be deferred from April 5th to April 7th. As he began, he requested, quote, pray that the Lord may strengthen my lungs. The wind was blowing hard, and the congregation was the largest that he had ever addressed. The strain he experienced during this sermon is evident from the remarks of the next day, April 8th, quote, it is just as impossible for me to continue the subject of yesterday as to raise the dead. My lungs are worn out. Perhaps these factors caused him to speak slowly, pausing frequently, perhaps possibly stopping for a few minutes occasionally to rest his lungs. If accurate, this would explain how the 1855 version appears to be a very full report and yet can be read aloud in less than one half the time that Smith occupied the stand. The second RLDS criticism. It was not found in print until after Joseph Smith's death, and hence was not subjected to his inspection as published. This statement is, of course, correct. However, preparation of the minutes of the conference for publication in the Church's Times and Seasons had been completed by April 28, 2 months before Smith's death. Although there is no evidence that he did inspect and approve the minutes, he certainly had the opportunity and the inclination, for on several previous occasions Smith did listen to and revise minutes. However, it seems certain that the minutes received at least the approval of the 12. As stated, they were prepared under their direction, and the publication supervised by two of their number, John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff. Also, there is no question of Smith's confidence in the previous work of the four reporters. Thousands had heard the discourse, and considerable objection to its teaching of the plurality of gods had been festering for 4 months by the time it was first published. If the report were in error on this subject, it is inconceivable that no one would have attempted to set the record straight. From both the opponents and proponents of the doctrine, there is no record of any expressed dissatisfaction with the 1844 printings of the discourse for some 30 years. Of the thousands who heard the discourse, not even one challenged its accuracy at that time. The third RLDS criticism. Its style and diction, as well as its doctrinal teachings, differ so widely from the productions of Joseph Smith as found elsewhere that it suggests suspicion as to its genuineness. What is Joseph Smith's style and diction? Only the most preliminary work has been completed to date on this question, but the reports of the discourse are so firmly established as genuine from external evidence and accurate as genuine and accurate and comprehensive that the style of Smith's discourse is nowhere better preserved. Rather than doubt its genuineness because of its style, it should be recognized as the best example of its style. In fact, the unique situation of the four reports makes this discourse the key to determining how well reports of his other discourses present his style and teachings. The four reporters of the discourse also recorded other statements, other of Smith's sermons. This opportunity now to compare and contrast the methods and abilities employed by these four reporters makes possible, to some degree, evaluation of their other reports of Smith's other sermons. One general observation is that Bullock was able to record the most, frequently writing in sentences. Clayton was a close second. Richard's report is a series of phrases stripped to the core. Woodruff's original report was probably a set of notes like Richard's, which he filled out as he wrote them into his diary. To respond to the charge that its doctrinal teachings differ widely from the productions of Joseph Smith as found elsewhere is beyond the scope of this paper, except perhaps to state that some 49 references showing the development of the doctrine of the plurality of gods and Smith's belief in them in 1844 have been collected and published. The fourth RLDS criticism, we have no evidence that a verbatim report was made when delivered, and hence it must have been written from memory or at best from notes. And this point, of course, has already been addressed. Recently, RLDS Apostle Aliyah G. Khoury has restated and discussed these points in his 1965 contrasting of LDS and RLDS claims in his The Truth and the Evidence. And in 1971, RLDS historian Richard P. Howard, with the tone of inquiry rather than polemics, restated these points in question form. For at least 90 years, the King Follett discourse has been unwelcomed in the RLDS profile of Joseph Smith, a profile considerably incomplete without it. Among LDS authorities, the plurality of gods was universally received and preached. It is difficult to turn more than several pages in the Journal of Discourses without encountering it in some form. The discourse was published at least 10 times by 1900 and frequently cited. However, the report of the discourse contains a concept which, after a number of years, was not acceptable among LDS. This situation predictably led many to doubt the accuracy of the report rather than to reject the teaching of Joseph Smith. The list of critics includes Orson Pratt, Joseph S. Smith, B.H. Roberts, George Albert Smith, and Charles W. Penrose. Examination of early records and diaries reveals that hardly a mother of several children escaped the heart-rending experience of losing a child in infancy. Near the end of his discourse, Smith sought to comfort them with these remarks. Quote, "Mothers, you shall have your children, for they shall have eternal life. But as the child dies, so shall it rise from the dead. It will never grow. It will still be the child in the precise form as it appeared before it died, but possessing all the intelligence of a god." This was neither the first nor the last time he taught this concept. In 1842, at the funeral of Windsor Lyon's child, Smith proclaimed, quote, "All men will come from the grave as they lie down, whether old or young. There will not be added unto their stature one cubit. Children will be enthroned in the presence of God and the Lamb with bodies of the same stature that they had on earth. They will there enjoy the fullness of that light, glory, and intelligence which is prepared in the celestial kingdom." This discourse was published in the Times and Seasons while Joseph Smith was its editor. It's also found in Wilford Woodruff's diary. Again, the record of this concept is found in William Clayton's diary of 18 May 1843. Quote, "I asked the President whether children who die in infancy will grow. He answered, no, we shall receive them precisely in the same state as they died, that is, no larger. They will have as much intelligence as we shall, but shall always remain separate and single." And finally, in public discourse, Smith again confirmed this concept on May 12, 6 weeks before his death. Quote, "In order for you to receive your children to yourself, you must have a promise, some ordinance, some blessing, in order to ascend above principalities. They must rise just as they died. We can there hail our lovely infants with the same glory, the same loveliness, and the celestial glory we all enjoy alike. They differ in stature, in size. The same glorious spirit gives them the likeness of glory and bloom." There is a consistent thought running through all of these statements that in the resurrection, those who died as infants will be of the same stature as when they died, but will not be denied any intelligence or glory, but will sit upon thrones and reign as gods. Of the reports of the King Follett discourse, three record this concept, and the harmony among them does not support the argument which was later advanced that this part of the discourse was inaccurately reported, which you can see in parallel number 2. No sources contemporary with Smith have been found which in any way contradict or modify his publicly and privately stated position. This subject of the stature of children in the resurrection received considerable attention from 1842 to the present. In an 1854 discourse, Brigham Young restated Smith's teaching with some expansion. Quote, "Little children can, after death, increase in all wisdom, power, glory, gifts, and blessings that pertain to the celestial kingdom. Suppose the inhabitants of the eternal world should range from 2 to 15 feet. What matter of that? This heavenly, beautiful, and glorious variety you discover in the works of God here below will be seen in the resurrection. You will see the child of 3, 4, and 5 years old possessing all the intelligence in them that makes them capable of enjoyment and duration. Resurrected bodies will be as diversified as the bodies of mortal flesh for variety, beauty, and extension. The height of my body, or its extension and width, will make no difference to my enjoyments and blessings in the eternal worlds." In 1861, Young addressed the subject again at the funeral of the infant son of Jesse C. Little, acknowledging that there had been considerable interest in the subject. Quote, "The question has often been asked how it is with little children, will they grow or not after? Joseph once said they would, and then he said they would not. He never had any revelation on the subject. I have no doctrine to give upon this subject. I believe in the great variety and the vast creation of God. I do not believe that the Lord ever made 2 worlds alike or 2 things alike in any world, nor that the human family has been alike in stature in the various ages of this world. The Lord has power to give a soul or spirit in a tabernacle 2 or 3 feet high as in a giant 8 or 10 feet in height. My doctrine or belief is that we shall find all children and people at the resurrection of the same stature as when they died." One feature of this sermon is Young's introduction of a degree of uncertainty as to Joseph Smith's final conclusion on the subject, which he again suggested in 1867, as recorded by Wilford Woodruff. President Young heard Joseph Smith say that little children would not grow after death, at another time that they would grow, and hardly knew how to reconcile. And then Young goes on, continued to present a reconciliation of the alleged contradictory statements of Joseph Smith. Quote, "He would like a variety in eternity. Children might grow in intelligence and not in stature as well as a given person. This seems consistent with Smith's teachings, that is, infants who die will in the resurrection continue to grow in intelligence, in knowledge, in glory, and in power and dominion, but not in stature. They will never grow. They will be in the precise form as when they fell in their mother's arms." There is no indication that Young ever questioned the accuracy of the report of the King Follett discourse. All evidence is that he had full confidence in the 1855 version of the report. As has already been pointed out, it was upon Young's final examination and approval, November 18, 1855, that the 1855 version was incorporated into the manuscript of the history of Joseph Smith then being completed. The saints were consoled by the teaching that one who dies in infancy is an heir of celestial glory, but not by the teaching of Smith and Young that the infant's growth and progress toward perfection will not be physical. Height was of no importance, but rather growth in wisdom, power, glory, intelligence, and dominion. According to Orson Pratt in 1873, this idea had caused quite an anxiety. Joseph S. Smith in 1918 confessed that he never did believe that those who died in infancy would remain as little children after the resurrection, yet did not have the courage to say so. The problem faced is obvious. What to do with this reported teaching of Joseph Smith, which was unacceptable? Orson Pratt suggested several possible solutions. One, the report of the sermon did not give Smith's full idea on the subject. Two, he had not been fully instructed by revelation on that point. Or three, Pratt had heard that shortly before his death, Smith can obtain further light on the subject to the effect that there would be growth after the resurrection. Either the report was an error, or Smith changed his mind, or both, and frequently both. Both B.H. Roberts and Joseph S. Smith, apparently not realizing their contradiction, employed both arguments at once, that Smith changed his mind after the King Follett discourse, and that he never taught the idea in the discourse but was misreported. During the final quarter of the 19th century, the idea which won almost universal acceptance among the LDS was that one who died in infancy would be resurrected as an infant and then nurtured to maturity by his mother from mortality. This allowed for an easy reinterpretation of Smith's reported statement. Yes, infants will be resurrected as infants. There is no growth in the grave, but they will then grow after the resurrection to their full stature. A few names from the long list of advocates of this concept are Orson Pratt, Franklin D. Richards, Wilford Woodruff, George Q. Cannon, B.H. Roberts, Joseph F. Smith, and more recently, Bruce R. McConkie and Joseph Fielding Smith. In support of this belief, several contemporaries of Joseph Smith in later years wrote statements to the effect that they had heard Smith teach that infants would grow after the resurrection. If Smith did reverse his position, no evidence of it from or near his era has yet been uncovered. Good sources establish Smith's doctrine on this point to have been consistent from March of 1842 to May of 1844, just 6 weeks before his death. It is not reasonable to discard the report of the King Follett discourse on the basis of several reminiscences which emerged from a period of LDS history charged with sentiment contrary to the doctrine expressed in the discourse. This is not just one lone isolated concept of Joseph Smith's which can simply be discarded without diminishing the ability to come to a clearer understanding of his thinking and theology. When he taught that those who die as infants will one day reign as gods upon thrones without one cubit added to their stature, what else was he saying? Was he saying that mortals' concepts of physical perfection will be meaningless in eternity? Was he stressing the non-physical attributes as being immeasurably more important than the physical? Was he saying that physical variety is even more important than our mortal quest for physical perfection? Was he saying that our concept of physical perfection is not related to eternal happiness, glory, power, or ultimate perfection? It may not be possible to answer these questions from the King Follett discourse, but an effort to answer these and others will be totally fruitless as long as Joseph Smith can only speak to us through the mouth of later Mormon tradition. One of the interesting episodes in the history of the King Follett discourse was its exclusion from the first edition of the History of the Church. The editor of the set, B.H. Roberts, had done considerable work on the discourse, preparing extensive footnotes in which he revealed considerable reverence for it, even though he doubted the accuracy of some parts of the text. To Roberts, it was the climax of Smith's teaching career. The type was set. It was to fill pages 302 to 317 of Volume 6 of the History of the Church. But at the last minute, without Roberts' knowledge or consent, those of higher authority decided to delete it, and the history appeared with 16 pages missing. An interesting reminiscence of Roberts' displeasure and reaction was related to the Mormon History Association in 1973 by the late T. Edgar Lyon. The reason for the deletion was stated in a letter by George Albert Smith, January 30, 1912, quote, "I have thought that the report of that sermon might not be authentic, and I have feared that it contained something that might be contrary to the truth. Some of the brethren felt as I did, and thought that greater publicity should not be given to that particular sermon. It is tempting to conclude that the subject responsible for its deletion from the history was the stature of children in the resurrection. It certainly was not the plurality of gods, and no other subject in the discourse had received any significant criticism. However, the discourse had been published 3 years earlier in the Improvement Era with Robert's footnotes. The problem of the disputed statement on children in the resurrection had been resolved by omitting the paragraph and including this footnote of Robert's. Quote, the omitted paragraph indicated by the asterisks refers to the exaltation and power that will be wielded by children in the resurrection before attaining to the development of stature of men and women, but which development will surely come to those who are raised from the dead as infants. It is quite evident that there was some imperfection in the report of the prophet's remarks at this point, and hence the passage is omitted. Further investigation reveals that probably another doctrine of the discourse was the immediate reason for its deletion from the history. In August of 1911, B.H. Roberts had completed Chapter 55 of the History of the Mormon Church, which was being published in the Americana, a historical magazine published by the National Americana Society in New York. This chapter was entitled The Prophet's Work, Mormonism, a System of Philosophy, and was devoted to a discussion of Joseph Smith's philosophical and theological beliefs. In 1930, this series of articles became the basis for Robert's six-volume comprehensive history of the church. In 1911, this chapter was reviewed and amended by President Joseph F. Smith's two counselors, Anthony H. Lund and Charles W. Penrose. One section of the chapter was disapproved by them and deleted, as explained in two of Anthony Lund's diary entries. Quote, today we had Brother Roberts read his article on the philosophy of the prophet Joseph Smith. Brother Penrose made a splendid speech on eternalism, opposing the view that Brother Brigham B. Roberts, who holds that intelligences were self-existent entities before they entered into the organization of the Spirit. And again on August 29th, he wrote, I spent the forenoon in the historian's office. Brother C.W. Penrose and I listened to Brother Roberts read his concluding chapter on the prophet Joseph Smith. We got him to eliminate his theories in regard to intelligences as conscious, self-existing beings or entities before being organized into spirits. His doctrine has raised much discussion, and the inference on which he builds his theory is very vague. The prophet's speech delivered as a funeral sermon over King Follett is the basis of Brother Roberts' doctrine, namely where he speaks of man's eternity claim. Roberts wants to prove that man then is coeval with God. He no doubt felt bad to have us eliminate his pet theory. This, I think he did too, as we will see. The section deleted in the Americana in 1911, perhaps by virtue of longevity, Roberts reinstated in his Comprehensive History of the Church in 1930. It contains quotations from the Book of Abraham, Chapter 3, and from the King Follett Discourse. From Lund's diary, it appears that the issue current at the very time that the discourse was deleted from the history of the church was that of intelligences existing as conscious entities before being organized into spirits. It thus seems probable that this issue was immediately responsible for its deletion, and again an unacceptable doctrine led to criticism of the text of the discourse. From April 7, 1844 to the present, the King Follett Discourse has spawned intense interest. It has been described as blasphemy and as glorious truth, and many descriptions in between. The preservation of pertinent manuscripts has led to a reliable reconstruction of Joseph Smith's comments on that occasion, and all portrayals of him which neglect the King Follett Discourse in whole or in part must continue to be needlessly incomplete or distorted.
My good friend Marvin Hill keeps writing me notes saying your time is up, and so I don't know what the niceties are here, but at least I hope if I'm not praised for my comments, I'm praised for reducing my comments to the least possible denominator, and I'll try my best to cut them down to just a couple of minutes. They paid me such a great salary to be here that I feel I have to at least earn the salary. I couldn't help but reflect that it's been over 15 years now since a lot of us began to talk about and write about and do a little more research on the first vision of Joseph Smith. And as every one of us have written an article here and there, we were absolutely sure that whatever we said at that time was going to solve all the problems for all time, and that somebody else would come along, and he was absolutely sure that he had solved all the problems. And I suppose what I'm saying, that the point about history is that none of us ever really solve all the problems, and Marvin, you haven't done either. So I hope you feel like you're in good company. The topics of these two papers are, of course, quite different in nature. But there's one important theme that both authors touch on that I can't help but begin my commentary with, and they didn't intend to make this their major theme, but it has to do with the historical development of Mormon doctrine, a topic that is receiving growing attention by Mormon scholars. In emphasizing the importance of the 1832 account of the first vision, Marvin also argues that Mormons should accept the idea that Joseph Smith gained the full understanding of the nature of God only after a period of time, not immediately in 1820. And then in discussing the King Follett sermon, Van Hale observed that some ideas presented by Joseph Smith were no longer acceptable to Latter-day Saints some 50 years later, and he raises the question as to how Latter-day Saints respond when they see an early leader teaching one thing that is no longer accepted by the Church. All this, it seems to me, only emphasizes the importance of including at least some historical perspective in our consideration of Mormon teachings. I'm sure that most Latter-day Saints who know much history are fully aware of the tremendous importance of the Nauvoo period to Mormon doctrine. Many of Joseph Smith's most far-reaching and unique revelations came in that period, as did some of his most significant sermons, such as the King Follett sermon. And so, speaking strictly as a church university teacher, and most of you know that I am that, and I am pretty much of a Mormon fundamentalist, I'm greatly concerned with the effect of what we historians do on the lives of our students. This makes it all the more important, it seems to me, that we help our students understand at least some of the historical problems, partly so that we're prepared to wrestle with similar problems when they come along in other forms. And the fact that so many of us face all the time is that historical problems do come along, and our college students, at least, become very much aware of them. Time after time, I have had students express deep concern over the fact that they are not prepared to handle the historical problems, such as the ideas presented in these two papers, when the problems were suddenly thrown at them, either by enemies of the church or by other college students. I believe that some insight into the history of church doctrine can go a long way to helping LDS students maintain their faith in the kind of revelation that I see as a church teacher again, comes line upon line, precept upon precept, as the church and its leaders are prepared to receive it. That is what gives students faith and insight into the need for continuing revelation. Now, all of this, of course, is personal testimony, but I need to get on to my friend Marvin Hill for just a minute. Seems to me that in a strictly academic and scholarly way, Marvin Hill has done Mormon scholars a service. Hill is a scholar of some national respect and has said, in effect, that those who respect his writings, that Joseph Smith was a man of personal integrity and one who could be trusted. While Hill does not directly approach the question of whether or not one can, quote, prove by empirical evidence that Joseph Smith did or did not have a vision, he nevertheless helps bring to the scholarly world the idea that Joseph was not a charlatan or a deliberate fraud. Hill apparently does not see the necessity to mix his personal faith in his scholarly writings, but his concluding statement nevertheless comes close to making that clear. He says, "All the sources that I have considered agree that Joseph Smith had an early vision between the ages of 14 and 15. But in asking Mormons to accept the primacy of the 1832 account over the official version written in 1838, he may be unrealistic with respect to how far the church can go. But at least he has rationalized for the scholars a way to look at both accounts with respect and without seeing fraud in either one." I do see a couple of problems, however, in Hill's articles, most of which could be easily solved. One has to do with semantics, as reflected in the title, a comment on sectarian versus historical interpretations. That term sectarian, especially if it's published where everybody is going to see it, is a very loaded term, and Hill never defines for us what he really means by it. One assumes that he is defining both the anti-Mormon writers and those whom he calls Mormon apologists as sectarians. But unless Hill defines what he means by the word sectarian, many, if not most, readers will be confused. This is compounded by the fact that neither does he clarify just who he is talking about when he uses another loaded term, apologist. This is usually a very negative term in its connotation, and yet he seems to apply it to certain people such as Hugh Nibley and Richard Anderson, whose work he also praises, at least in the footnote in his article. And when he suggests that somehow Mormon apologist, and does that mean sectarian, is somehow working in opposition to historical interpretation, how does he define which is which? He seems to like some of my work, for example, yet I have publicly classified myself as an apologist in the positive sense, who tries to come to terms with all the implications of his history. Now, my own stabs at definition may also be problematical, but I make these comments simply to suggest that Hill may be more effective if he could find some way to avoid using such loaded terms as sectarian and apologist that may tend, because they are loaded, to lead some people away from his main points. I also need to give my good friend a gentle chiding on another and relatively minor point. He seems, in one sense, to be almost guilty as I am in setting up a straw man in places. That is, he talks about the scoffers and the naysayers as opposed to the apologists, and then carves out his own position somewhere in between. In doing this, he almost leaves the impression that there has been no middle ground writers. It's true, of course, that on his particular issue, no one has approached it like him, but at least he should observe that there have been all kinds of scholars and writers who have approached Mormonism from a rather neutral point of view. That is, they haven't attempted either to prove or disprove the faith, and we could list a lot of them. With respect to Van Hale, and I just skipped three pages of criticism of Marvin Hill, I'm impressed. And I should say that, especially after the section of his that deals with the history of the text, to me the most interesting part of the talk was the question that he raises about the reaction of Mormons when they find that something that was taught in one generation is no longer the doctrine of the Church. The evolution of attitudes toward the King Follett discourse is certainly a revelation of the fact that Mormons feel uncomfortable, and rightly so, when they find themselves seeming to disagree either with an early or a contemporary prophet. The only alternative is either to say that they are wrong now, that the early prophet was wrong then, that the early prophet's words were recorded inaccurately, or that some of the statements made were simply a matter of personal opinion and not a matter of revelation or church doctrine. Hale has handled the various views on the King Follett discourse very well, and made a good observation when he said that any effect or any effort to discuss Joseph Smith's philosophy without considering the King Follett discourse is incomplete or distorted. The main value, then, it seems to me, in this article, and I hope that it sees the light of publication, is the insight it gives us into the workings of the minds of both RLDS and LDS writers who have attempted to confront the issue from time to time. Thank you very much.